You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, January 14th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Georgetown University, Qatar, Carl Weiderquist, on the basic income guarantee. Something we've been wanting to explore for some time. Also on today's program, 5 million copies of Charlie Hebdo sold out throughout France, particularly in Paris today. Meanwhile, the French government has arrested dozens on speech violations, just to add to the comedy, I guess. Also on the program today, Rand Paul staffs up for his run. The GOP clown car getting a little bit tight. General Petraeus looking at potential charges. Fox has figured out the reason why. Infighting with the Policemen's Benevolent Association in New York. Horrible story of a church which basically ended a funeral 15 minutes in when the pastor found out that the deceased was gay. Also, votes in the House on to overturn essentially the president's immigration actions tied in with the Department of Homeland Security funding. We will get to that. It looks like there's going to be amendments on this Keystone vote dealing with global warming. Antonio Weiss, the would-be number three at Treasury Department, drops out, or I guess pulls his own nomination for another position. Don't feel too bad for him. He got a non-confirmable position at the Treasury Department. And, of course, you know what happens when you get one of those, don't you? $20 million in your stock vests because you're going into government work. I mean, not for you. I'm saying for him. I'm not even saying for one. I'm saying for him. What is it?
I'm making the money.
There you go. Exactly.
They say no. I go another way and I still make the money.
Yeah. Oh, you won.
I will Senator, three more.
Senator Warren, you won. I just get $20 million.
Thank you, Senator Warren. Either
exactly.
way, I will get this.
Unbelievable.
More literary journals for me.
Yeah,
to
exactly.
To run and operate this mess.
Paris Review, and then we'll make another one, maybe the Brussels Review.
Hobbies, Paris Review, tax fraud,
exactly.
Advising Treasury.
all that and more on today's program. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this program possible. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. We can't do the show without you. And, you know, there's a natural turnover with some of our supporters. A lot of people email me. They apologize, and they basically tell me they've lost a job or that someone's sick or they just can't do it. And so we rely on those people who do have the financial resources to support this program. Also, if you like coffee, there is absolutely no reason for you not to be buying your coffee at justcoffee.coop. It's fair trade coffee. They have tea and chocolate. You can get organic if you want it. They ship it to your house. And you use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And you can buy the Majority Report blend. We have a bag sitting right there on the new shelf that I built. Michael didn't even comment on it.
Very nice shelf, Sam. There's two of them. I see Handyman Magazine at work.
Great job. Thank you. And, of course, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. Just click on the link, bookmark it, and we get a kickback. We're going to be right back with Professor Carl Weidquist. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Associate Professor, Georgetown University, Qatar, speaking to us from Qatar, Carl Weidquist. Carl, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So there's a couple of things that I want to talk to you. You've written extensively about what you call the basic income guarantee. Some people call it a guaranteed annual income. There's multiple names, and I think maybe you can parse that for us. I want to talk to you about that, and also work that you have done in tearing apart the dilemma of libertarianism, which I've read a lot of your work. I enjoy it and wanted to discuss it with you. But I know this February, in fact, there is a meeting of the 14th Annual North American Basic Income Guarantee Congress in New York. Tell us, what is the Basic Income Guarantee?
Okay, well, the Basic Income Guarantee is the idea that income doesn't have to start at zero. That we have an incentive-based market system where you buy and you sell and you trade. The more that you sell of whatever you have, whether it's your labor or anything else, the more money you get. But the way we have it set up is that if you don't own anything that you can sell except for your labor, then your income starts at zero, which causes all kinds of problems, such as homelessness, poverty, suffering, and a desperation to take any job that's available, and quite a few opportunities for employers to take advantage of this. And so, well, the idea of a basic income guarantee is to have the income start at some higher level, hopefully enough to meet everybody's basic needs, so that you're not destitute, you're not without food, shelter, and clothing. You've got enough to buy this stuff. But otherwise, the market system can work just the same. You go out, you get a job, you make more money on top of your basic income guarantee. That's the simple idea.
So is this a universal payment that would presumably come from the government? And we should say that Switzerland, I believe it was maybe a year and a half ago now, or just over a year, had a referendum to vote on the on providing a basic or a, I should say, a universal basic income. But my recollection is that referendum failed. But is that basically programmatically? How would it look?
Oh no, it hasn't. It hasn't failed. It's very complex. What's going on in Switzerland is that they had a successful petition initiative to call for a referendum, and they gathered the petitions in September of 2013. So it's been nearly a year and a half. And so you think, wow, if I haven't heard anything about this referendum going through, then it must have failed sometime in the year and a half. But the way
that's
it works
exactly
in Switzerland for a national referendum is it takes 3 years to go from getting the petition in to actually having the ballot. So the next thing that happens is the government writes a report on it, and then somehow the government is brought in to draft it. Whereas in the U.S., whenever there's a petition drive, it's always the people who put forth the petition who actually then can write the thing just as it will appear on the ballot. But in Switzerland, the government ends up doing that. So we don't know exactly what the wording will be. So it's still probably over a year yet.
Okay.
Until they actually have this vote. So it'll be coming back in the news in Switzerland soon. There was another petition drive in the European Union as a whole. But that raised almost 300,000 signatures. But they asked for 1 million signatures, which is very hard to get.
All right, great. Well, so then getting back to the idea of how would it actually work? I mean, what does it mean? Does it mean essentially that a government would provide X number of dollars annually to whom?
Well, this depends on which model of basic income guarantee you're talking about. You asked about the different terms. The way the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee Network has used the term since the turn of the century is that a basic income guarantee is sort of a generic term for any sort of policy that's going to make sure income doesn't start at zero. You have some unconditional income that you can get. Now, there's two ways you can do that. There's two main ways you can do that. One is that you can give a check or a bank transfer to every single person, whether they work or not. Then you just tax what money they make privately, so everyone will both receive a basic income and pay taxes. That's called the unconditional basic income, the universal basic income, or just basic income. Now, the other way to do it is usually called the negative income tax, which is to say, okay, we want income not to start at zero. We want everybody to have access to that, but we don't want to have everyone both receiving the basic income and paying taxes. So we're only going to give it to those whose income would put them as a net recipient. So you have people that have no income get the full amount, the same as the basic income as they would under unconditional income. But for every dollar they make privately, you take some of that back. So it sort of phases out as your income gets higher. That's the negative income tax. Both of them guarantee unconditionally that every person will have an income that's non-zero, hopefully enough to meet their basic needs.
Let me just to clarify. So conceptually, when we talk about a negative income tax, we're basically talking about a means-tested payment.
Uh, a negative income tax is means tested, but unconditional. And the means testing causes several problems, which is one of the reasons a lot of people say that the unconditional basic income model is better.
The means testing is conditioned, right? It's conditioned upon your income.
Yes. In one sense, it's unconditional that we're going to make sure that everybody has enough income to live on, whether they work or not.
Okay.
So you get something even if you don't work. So everybody in the whole country can get that. But the problems it causes is then if your income goes down, you have to apply for it.
Right.
Whereas if you have basic income, you're always getting that money. There's no chance of falling through the cracks if your income goes down. And another problem is you have the problem of taking the family into account, the family size. And, okay, what if my spouse makes a lot of money, but I don't? And if we're filing our taxes together, you wouldn't get a negative income tax. You would get a basic income. And this doesn't sound like such a big deal. Well, you're married to somebody who makes a lot of money, but well, not every family is as sharing as we would like them to be. And you get some families where one spouse will take all the money and the other spouse and the children will end up being very poor.
Hmm. All right. So now why, I think in general, I love the idea of this. But why not? I mean, what is problematic if we're talking about now individual spouses? How will we deal with family units? Will we take into consideration like the children? Will children get it? Let me put it this way: beyond the principle that it is problematic for people to start at zero. In terms of their income, I mean, what are the other benefits of it, or is that fundamentally it? And would this replace the welfare state? I mean, is that what it's supposed to do? I mean, that's where it starts to get, I think, you know, in terms of implementation, a little problematic from my perspective. But let me hear your take on that.
Yeah, now you're getting into many of the differences even within the negative income tax and the unconditional basic income model. There's so many different ways people propose it. Some say it should be just for adults. Some say it should be every man, woman, and child, regardless of anything. And some say it can replace almost the whole welfare state. Others say, well, it can only replace certain parts of the welfare state. It can certainly replace something. If you got somebody who is in a country that has a generous unemployment insurance system where a single person is getting $25,000 a year in unemployment insurance, you don't want to give them a $25,000 basic income on top of that. So a single person has $50,000 a year. That's not going to be sustainable. It can replace some things, but how much it can replace is something that's open to issue and whether it should apply to children. My concern is that every single person on the world not have to live in poverty. So that somehow we get a policy where everyone knows every week they're getting an income comes in that's enough to keep them out of poverty. So that everybody has enough food to eat, decent shelter, clothes to wear, and the necessities of life. Now, how you do that is less important to me. It's more of a strategic question. But once you're doing that, a lot of things that the welfare state is doing, you don't need. Other things Right. you do need. You're still going to need wheelchairs for people who are disabled. You're going to need leader dogs for the blind. You might need to have more for old people because they've worked all their lives. It's not going to replace the entire pension system and so on. You also have to take into account children. Now, there are two. If we paid every adult a basic income high enough that they could raise a child on it, you could conceivably eliminate all poverty with an adults only basic income guarantee. However, then you would end up giving adults without children something that's much higher than the poverty rate, which is probably not necessary. And then on the other hand, if you give it to everyone with children, then every time somebody has a child, you've got to increase the size of it. Some people have argued that you should have a smaller amount for children because once you've got your apartment or a couple has their apartment and their house and their bills and all that, a child costs less than a full adult. Probably the most realistic proposal is something that has a smaller amount for children and that it's built on top of Social Security so that you're not going to get rid of something that's already been shown to work very well.
I guess, as I dig into this, I guess, what my response is, part of this is, people have been asking me about this since I think, the petition to create a referendum in Switzerland. And I've been digging into it. And one of the things that occurs to me, I'm definitely on board with the idea that that people should not be we should not have people living in poverty. And this seems to be on first principles, I think that's in terms of outcomes, that's an outcome that I definitely appreciate. And the idea that you don't have to apply for it is the most attractive part about it, that it's automatic. But as you start to sort of parse out the differences, for instance, okay, like you say, if you're an older person, you're going to want to have a pension system for that person as well. So that's, in my mind, Social Security. You're also probably going to want for older people or people who are sick or maybe everyone some form of health insurance. So there we are in Medicare and Medicaid. In terms of payments to people with families, one of the things that is very problematic from a policy standpoint in my mind, it was the so-called welfare reform in '96, which made temporary assistance to needy families basically contingent upon work. It basically destroyed the TAMF in many respects. So I guess from my perspective, when we start to get down into the details, what it sounds like to me is simply shoring up those areas of our safety net that we have attacked over the years. Why wouldn't, let's say, reversing welfare reform from 96, increasing payments, and simply being more generous based upon need, why wouldn't that be just as effective?
Well, because even the more generous welfare system that the U.S. had in place in the 60s and 70s, more generous compared to what it is now, it wasn't working all that well. It was doing a lot of good, but for a lot of people. But it was very wasteful, and it was in many ways paternalistic and cruel. And it was still very conditional. It's that you had to demonstrate need, and you had to demonstrate these different kinds of need. So if you're a single mother, that was one kind of need. If you're old, that's another kind of need. If you're disabled, that's another. If you're unemployed, that's another. And the administrative cost in separating these people was a lot of money. And it gives then the system a way to be paternalistic over them, say, well, are you really in need? Let me investigate you again to make sure that you're really in need. And you end up with a lot of wasted effort on the part of our effort and funds on the part of our government into policing people, and then a lot of wasted effort on the part of the recipients on satisfying the policing of people. And a consequence of that is a lot of people that then aren't helped when they really need help. And if you've got a basic income, you got a system that helps everybody that needs help.
But haven't we just gone through as we talked about this, these conditions, like if you have children or not, or if you're older, or if you need a wheelchair. I mean, that's what seems to be problematic. Like, the idea itself I like, but when we start talking about putting it in practice, we end up putting these conditions. And, you know, if you're going to have a wheelchair, you got to show me that you need a wheelchair. And then we need someone to sit there and be the person who decides whether or not someone needs a wheelchair or determine whether they do. I mean, I agree I'm not so convinced either about the administrative costs. I mean, we can talk about that, but most of these programs, as far as I know, relatively speaking, are actually not that expensive to administer. But be that as it may, it seems to me that it's inevitable that we're going to end up with conditions. And that's, that's what occurs to me is sort of like problematic. And then we're moving into like a strategic standpoint, then we're talking about, are we expending political energy on a program? And I like the idea from a philosophical standpoint, but are we expending political energy on a program that really, in the end, is just going to give us more or less, I'm not saying that we couldn't make vast improvements on what we have, though, structurally?
These are good questions. You're asking things that I don't typically get asked, so this is very good. About the administrative costs, I did a paper with Michael Lewis more than 10 years ago now, I think, where we looked at the issue of administrative costs, and we looked at a bunch of different programs, and you see an enormous range of how what the overhead costs of for every dollar that they're spending on it, how much actually goes into the pockets of the recipients. And I don't remember the exact figures, but it was a wide range of something like 10% for 10%. That means a dime for every dollar we spend was actually going to recipients for the worst of these programs. I think that was TANF, but I'm not sure. To over 90% for Social Security. The thing about Social Security, it is the simplest one.
Right.
It is you're this age. You put this in, you get that money, you buy that money every year for the rest of your life with a COLA adjustment or whatever. Very simple, very effective, low overhead costs. Now, what I want to do with basic income is to create a right of citizenship for the normal needs person, a person that has so everybody has at least the needs of a normal person, so that all those needs, your basic needs for food, shelter, and clothing are going to be covered by this basic income. That's a right of citizenship. Is your share of the ownership in our country? You get that every month. No conditions. No categorizing. No means testing. Everybody gets that as a right of citizenship. Now, if you're going to say you need more than that, I need more than the typical needs person, or I deserve more than the typical needs person, then you have to show some kind of condition. Say, okay, I've worked for 50 years, I should get a pension because of this. Okay, well, then that'll be conditional. Or I can't walk, I need a wheelchair, that will be conditional. But the main basic needs that we all shared will be covered without means test or work requirement.
I have kids. That's conditional, right?
It's not so much we're giving you a reward for having kids, but we're recognizing that the kids have needs.
Or we're just paying the kids.
You're taking it as a fiduciary for the children.
Right. I mean, I think the idea is fascinating, and I like the principle behind it, because I think that I like the principle behind it. And I'm not sure if it ends up achieving, in practice, if it ends up achieving the gains necessarily that it's supposed to, but, it's a fascinating idea. And I want to leave it at that for the moment and turn to, some other work that you've done in terms of, a paper that I guess was cited I cannot remember the context in which it had been cited in someone else's work, and I ended up reading it. It was one that you had written a while back entitled A Dilemma for Libertarianism. And let's talk about that, because it is – I've spent a lot of time on this program over the years debating libertarians, and I anticipate that we're going to hear more about libertarianism at least to a certain degree with Rand Paul today staffing up his campaign to the extent that he's a legitimate libertarian. But why don't you tell us what is the primary dilemma for libertarianism as you've written it?
Well, I should take this opportunity, since we're transitioning from basic income into libertarianism, I should take this opportunity to tell you the connection between my work on the two things. Which is that I'm actually a fallen libertarian. It was libertarians who interested me in basic income. When when I was a kid, about 15 years old, Milton Friedman had a television show called Free to Choose, which I was very interested in, watched the whole thing, bought the accompanying book, read the stuff, and it had a chapter about what he was using the name the guaranteed income or the negative income tax as a solution to poverty, which I thought is that is a very good challenge to the left. If you really care about the poor, you should stop being paternalistic with them and just start giving them money. Now, for a while, I actually thought I was a libertarian. And then for a while, I started using the term left libertarian, which I don't have anything against some people who use that term, but I don't use it because I don't want to be associated with libertarians. And because I found most libertarians, they talk a good game about freedom, but what most of their policies do, with the exception of those who support basic income, not even all of their, I mean, some of their policies are about freedom, drug legalizing or something like that, but most of their economic policies are not about freedom. They're about privilege. They're about entitlement. It's about leaving the property owner free to do whatever they want with their property, but ignoring just the very fact that the government establishes their property and calls them a property owner without getting the consent of the people that thereby makes propertyless is not defending freedom. It's defending a one-sided case of privilege at the expense of freedom. And so the dilemma paper that I wrote is something that talks along those lines. Now, your question was, what is this dilemma that I'm giving to libertarians? Am I?
Yes, and I should say I'm happy that you're a fallen libertarian. That's why our phones seem to be working so well. We seem to always have a problem with our phones when we're talking to actual self-identified libertarians, but I digress. But yes, I mean, tell us what that, and I think that you've touched on what you've written is that dilemma of libertarianism, is that in espousing a property right, it contradicts their notion of, I guess, of monopoly of power. Do I have that right?
Well, it is actually, although what the thing that I mentioned is sort of a dilemma. That's not the thing that I define as a dilemma for libertarianism in that paper, which has to do with the natural rights version of libertarianism, their argument from the appropriation of property. Say, why is it that they say that it's an affront to freedom when the government taxes or regulates or redistributes private property. They say, well, you have this story of the appropriation of property where the Lockean appropriator goes out by himself into the wilderness and appropriates property by mixing his labor with it, starting a farm, and then selling that farm to other people. And then you could get a capitalist economy by repeated applications, this appropriation and inheritance and resale. And that's what they say is happening. Now, and then they say, and then the government, if the government then comes along And then when all of these rights are established, that it would be interfering with these established human rights. What I do in the dilemma papers, I assume, okay, let's just assume that's a right, that you have a right to appropriate property and you have a right to buy, sell, and trade it, and the government and no one else, government or anyone else, has any right to redistribute that to maintain some notion of equality. Well, we could get a capitalist system out of that, but how do we know we wouldn't get this scenario where someone says, okay, I'm just going to defend my own territory. I'm not going to join any protective organization to become a libertarian, to be part of any libertarian state. I'll just run my territory as if I was a king. And then I bring in some vassals and I get some strategic marriage alliances with other landowners, and my estate gets larger and larger, and one day one of my subsequent descendants is the Queen of England, and then I own the entire all of England, and I can tax and regulate England all that I want to, and I can give out people a quasi-ownership called title, but this is of course a subordinate title. That it's a subordinate title to my title as the ultimate authority, as the queen. And so the dilemma here is that repeated applications of this theoretical story of appropriation, inheritance, and transfer can justify monarchy just as well as they can justify a private property capitalism. So the dilemma for libertarianism is that if they stick with this, if they the objection they could make is to this would be to say, well, that's too much inequality. But they've already said, oh, well, we don't have any arguments against too much inequality, that there shouldn't be any arguments against too much inequality. It's just about repeated applications of appropriation, transfer, inheritance, and so forth. So they don't end up having any argument against the government owning the whole property. And then what I conclude is that we then could be living in a world where there are 200 or so, we're actually in an anarcho-capitalism where we have 200 or so really big institutions that are just land-holding institutions, which like to call themselves government, but there's no reason to believe their ownership of property is any less legitimate than the ownership claims held by corporations and individuals.
I mean, I think that's a fascinating way to put it. I'm going to definitely question some libertarians in the future, hopefully, on that dilemma. I mean, that's fundamentally what it breaks down to, right, is that it's really simply an argument for feudalism. That when you simply say there should be no monopoly of force by the government, but it's okay to have monopoly of force by some other entity that is basically a government, but they just don't call themselves a government.
Yes, exactly. And what the typical response of a libertarian when I tell them this story, well, suppose the government is the successor of the original appropriator, well, we say, well, that's not realistic. The government doesn't have rights that stem from original appropriation, which is exactly what just about everyone else says when they hear the libertarian story of this individual appropriator going out into the wilderness and starting his farm. That is not where private property rights come from either. Private property rights come from a long history of violence where people have established them by force, usually against people who were practicing more collectivist institutions before, if you go back far enough. So the unrealisticness of the story of the queen having being the descent of the property original property rights owner is no less or more unrealistic than the private property rights owner. So they have no reason to distinguish. What they want is a monopoly of violence by property owners, but they have no argument then against a monopoly of violence by the government.
It's fascinating stuff, and I want to definitely open up the forum if there's any libertarians who would like to call in and provide an answer for that dilemma. I'm certainly hoping to hear it. Professor Carl Weiderquist, thank you so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it. Where can people go to get more information on a guaranteed income?
I would suggest go to basicincome.org, binews.org, which is basic income news, a news website with daily news on basic income, or in the United States to usbig.net, which is where the U.S. Basic Income Guarantee posts its info.
All right, great. We will post that usbig.net on our front page at majority.fm. Thanks again for your time today.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye. Clear as crystal clear phone connection.
Sam, I think the professor's missing few aspects of, I guess I'd think of as something along the lines of naturalized freedom, which I think a lot of other callers haven't mentioned. Am I still on the air?
I was wondering where you're going to go with that. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, headed to the fun half. I got so much news. I'm so backed up here, and even more backed up because Friday I will be out for my colonoscopy. No joke. I mean, assuming my insurance.
Probably some jokes could be wrung out of that.
Yeah. Silly, and people should call in and tell me about this because I don't put this out there. My insurance company is telling me that they're not going to. I have to go through some type of hoops now. I got a call from the doctor. It said, "Look, your insurance company is saying that they won't pay for the anesthesiologist," and I'm like, "Wait, what? They want me to do this without any anesthesia?" And it's not. You don't get knocked out cold. You get what is known as like a semi-conscious anesthesia or twilight anesthesia.
Sounds great.
Oh,
that has to be the best part of the experience they're trying to rob you of.
I'm telling you, that is actually the most fun. It's I got the name of here. It's like propofol or something. And so I called the insurance company, and they're like, "Yeah, no, you need to tell us whether or not it's medically necessary." And I'm like, "Well, I'm not a doctor, but my doctor's saying it's medically necessary. So I think it sounds like it's medically necessary." But, you know, the whole thing just raises, first of all, just a myriad of, and apparently, you know, my insurance company changed their policy 2 years ago about this. Obviously, I haven't gotten a colonoscopy for 5 or 6 years. I think that they, you know, and I've Googled online, I used the Google, and I found that there was a couple of other insurance companies who were attempting to do this, but they've ultimately decided, like, it may discourage people from getting these screenings, and these screenings ultimately end up saving the insurance company money because it prevents potential cancers, colon cancers in the future. And, but it just goes to, like, the whole notion of things like medical savings accounts and what, you know, this idea that, like, we can be better consumers of our health care. Yeah, no, I can't. I, you know, like, if I wanted to go to medical school or maybe just take, like, a learning annex course for, like, 6 to 8 weeks, I suppose I could learn, like, the fundamental differences. Do they really need to have an anesthesiologist there to administer this stuff? Or is there some other thing? Can I get a shot of Novocaine?
In a natural environment?
Sorry. I mean, these are all those questions that I just don't feel competent to answer. And that's why, you know, on some level, things like Medicare are, you know, because Medicare basically says, we have data. We have so many Medicare patients that we can actually find data on this and determine whether or not, yes, an anesthesiologist should be there for propofol or not. Someone just IM'd me that propofol was, and I may be mispronouncing it, I'm sure I am, was the drug that Michael Jackson was hooked on. And I can tell you, after my last experience with a colonoscopy, like, but for the fact that it was a colonoscopy, You get that stuff. I'm surprised that people aren't just lining up for another one the next day. All right, we got to take a break. We'll come back. The House just voted to basically amend the funding of the Department of Homeland Security with an attack on both deferred action programs, both the original Dreamers action as well as the most recent act, executive action by President Obama. And what's going to happen, well, we'll talk about it in the funner half. 646-257-3920. The IM is Majority FM. Folks, get the app. Not only, even if you're a freebier, even if you're a freeloader, continue to give and give and give and give and give.
Just take more, leeches.
Take more.
Just take more.
Take more. Take the free app.
What are you
waiting
for?
Put it on your phone, which probably you got for free.
You're the type of people who goes to a party and sneaks, like, you know, food and hors d'oeuvres out in your jacket pockets. Take the app. It's free.
Take the app. It's free. You can listen.
Universal basic
app. You can listen
app.
Live. You can listen to the, I think, freebies, I think, get like the last 50 shows on the app searchable. If you're a member, you get 1,050 shows searchable. Get the app. You can IM me with one touch. You can call with one touch. You could theoretically purchase stuff through Amazon with one touch or go and become a member with one touch, but I know you won't do that. But get the app. It's free. It's advertiser free. That's what I got to change. And if you want, leave the notifications on. The only notifications we ever give you, I suppose there's been one or two occasions where we added something else, but it's 80% of the time of the week, I remember to just tell you who the guest is that day, and that's it.
And we're also launching a Kickstarter campaign to get the funds to put Sam under for this procedure.
That's right. we're gonna amend the Indiegogo campaign that we were working on to include getting an anesthesiologist in there. So we'll be back tomorrow for those of you who are leaving us now. But for those of you sticking around, stick around. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back.